Hey, what's up? It's Marcus Williams, and I am joined by Steve Cooper, the founder and president of Cry in the Dark, an incredible organization that does an incredible amount of good. So, Steve, why don't you tell us your story?
Back in 1998, I found out personally about a situation of a group of children, special needs orphans, who were suffering quite badly in a state-run orphanage in northeast of Romania. And so when I found out about these kids who were suffering in this orphanage, I saw photographs, I saw a video, I felt, you know, I was being called really to help these kids. It didn't happen straight away. I didn't just fly off to Romania straight away. It took a while for me to go. And I spoke to some people in my church. And I also spoke to some friends. Because I was just an electrician.
Right.
That's what I was. I wasn't running a charity. I wasn't running an NGO. I was just an electrician. But I really believed that, you know, as a Christian, I should be doing something with my faith instead of just talking about it and going to church. It has to be active. And so I ended up going out to Romania in February 1998. I went with three friends, and I had never been to this part of Romania before. And we arrived on the Friday night in Bucharest, which is the capital. We got a train up to a place called Ajud, and then we were picked up in this little like dacha car, which was sort of falling apart a little bit.
Right.
And we were driven like an hour to a town called Comenești. And we stayed overnight in a place called the Robert Cole Centre, which was a school for special needs kids. It wasn't like a boarding school, so it was empty. We'd stayed there. On the Saturday morning, we were taken down to the orphanage where these children were. And it was an old dilapidated palace. I think it had once been owned by the royal family of Romania, who are now no longer in power. They were kicked out by the communists, probably back in the 1950s, 1940s, when Romania became communist. And we went into the building, and it was pretty bare. It was just like plain wooden floors, and we walked into this room, and some of the children, they were sort of partially clothed, so they just had t-shirts on. Some had no pants on. The heads were shaved, and some of the kids had been told to sit on pieces of material or small pieces of carpet, and they were sitting under the stairs, and they'd been sort of told by the staff not to move off of these pieces of material because they'd cleaned the floors because, you know, people were coming and they didn't want it to appear to be look good, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So there was 26 kids in there, all with varying degrees of disability, mental and physical. And because I knew that if we wanted to help these kids, we needed to have some evidence of what was going on, I'd taken my video camera in, and I started to film, and just, there was two members of staff there, that was all, and they just sort of stood by and watched. And as I started to film, this little girl, who we now have in our care, so I know her, her name's Roxana Nikita, and she suffers from the effects of autism, so she's quite deeply entrenched autistic. She came over to me, and she grabbed my hand, and she led me across the floor to a doorway which was shut, and she opened the door and sort of pulled me into this room, and it was pitch black, couldn't see anything, and as I walked across the floor of this room, I had stumbled over something. And what I realised I stumbled on was a small child lying on the floor, covered in her own excrement. The little girl I stumbled over, I now know as Doina, and Doina suffers with cerebral palsy. She doesn't talk, she doesn't walk, and I don't know how long she'd been left on the floor for. And at that point, I realised I was in a dormitory. There was beds in there, and my friend came in, Andy. And he had a torch, and we shone the torch, and we realised there were blankets nailed up to the windows. There were no lights, and there were probably about three or four other children just sitting on the beds, staring at us, looking at us in the darkness. And at that point, for me, after that, a woman rushed in because she realised we'd gone into that room, and she sort of pushed us out of the way. And she grabbed the little girl, Dinah, and she grabbed her by the wrist, and she sort of picked her up and dangled her in the air. She didn't hold her like you would a normal child. And she just dropped her onto this bed, still covered in her own excrement. And what amazed me was she then left the room, and she came back and cleaned the floor, but left the child.
Jeez, wow.
So at that point, as I say, I realised I was in this dormitory. I just felt, again, for me, I just felt, you know, God say to me, enough is enough. And I went back to where I was staying that night with my friends. And I didn't sleep very well because, you know, I was thinking about these kids. They were just a couple of miles down the road, 5 miles down the road. And I didn't sleep very well. And I just started to cry out, really, and pray for these kids. As I did, I just felt really that my heart was broken for them. And so after that, we came back. And as you know, what Christians do, we held a prayer meeting. And as we was praying, I heard one of my sisters, because I've got two sisters, I heard one of my sisters say this, because we were like thinking about what we should do for these kids, trying to seek a way, trying to focus on what we should do. And as we was praying, my sister said, but Father God, nobody hears the cries of these children apart from you. They just cry in the dark. And as my sister said, cry in the dark, it was like bing,
there it is,
there it is, you know, for an electrician it's quite apt. It's like somebody switches the light on, bing, you know, if we're gonna have a fund or a project, we should call it Cry in the Dark, because that's exactly what these kids were doing. So to cut a long story short, we started a fund originally with the idea of building a new home for these children in Romania. And after 2 years, because this was 98, by May 2000, we'd bought a piece of land in Romania. We'd bought an old house on it, renovated it. We'd formed an organisation in Romania, which I'm the president of as well. So I have sort of oversight to what goes on in Romania. And in May 2000, the 28th of May 2000, which is near, oh gosh, it's nearly 15 years ago, we moved the children, apart from two, which had died in state care. They were in state care and had died. And we moved them to their new home, Casa Lumina, which means House of Light in Romanian. And it's been their home ever since. We've had because there's complications with the kids' health. Many of our children have hepatitis, and so there's complications with the health. We lost another two, so we have 22 now in our care. And it's a 24/7 care home, so we have about 32 staff there, and it's all funded. It was originally funded really from the UK, but now we're now seeing, because we've now put a fundraiser in place in Romania, and we're now seeing income coming in from Romania to support some of the work we do. So not all the income has to come from abroad, it's coming from within Romania, which is what we're about really as an NGO, is getting them to sustain and support themselves without, you know, wanting too much help from the outside. So that's Casa Lumina. That was our first project. And our other project is a community hospice project, and it's called Hospice Casa Elbert. And there's a couple of reasons why we work in the community, and I'll sort of move on to that later, if we're allowed to, and explain a little bit about why there's such a problem with HIV/AIDS still in Romania. So we were obviously visiting Casa Lumina. I'd go every few months or every 5 months or 6 months to make sure the projects were running okay. And on a Sunday, I would go to a Baptist church, which was next door to our orphanage, because, you know, it was as close to what I could. Didn't understand a word of what was going on, but I'd go anyway.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, and one Sunday I was coming out of church, and this little boy came up to me, and he had a shirt and tie on. And stood about, you know, 3 or 4 foot off. He wasn't very big.
Yeah.
And he come up to me and he said in English with a little Romanian accent,
yeah,
"Hello, my name's Albert."
yeah,
and put his hand out. So I was like, hi, Albert, you know, nice to meet you. My name's Steve. And we became sort of friends, real good friends. And I'd see Albert every time I go to Romania. And I found a few things out about Albert. I realised that his mum had died when he was about 10 or 11. His father was an alcoholic, wasn't around much for him. And he was actually living with his auntie and his cousin in a small apartment block quite close to our orphanage. And so when I'd go to Romania, I'd try and see Albert, and we'd invite him to Casa Lumina and give him something to eat. And many people got to know Albert, who came from England to visit, and they would bring him a jacket or a coat, and you know, just to help him really, because he's quite a poor family. And one thing we tried not to do, we didn't encourage giving money to people. We would rather give food, or we'd give something. And we became really good friends. And Albert was an amazing little boy. He had such an inquiring mind, and probably the biggest brown eyes I've ever seen in my life. And he was a great kid, and I loved him. And he used to go to the Baptist church, as I say. And one day, I've got to tell this story, and I hope it doesn't offend anyone.
Go ahead, yeah.
Okay, so, and if you have to edit it out, you have to, but I've got to tell you this story. One day I was in Casa Lumina, and Albert come up to me, and he had this little black book in his hand. And he said, "Hi, Steve." He said, "You see this? This is my Bible." So I said to him, "Yeah, I know it's your Bible, Albert, you know." Yeah. So he says, "Well, you see this Bible?" He said, "I take this Bible to school." So I said, "Okay, cool." He said, "I tell my friends about Jesus." So I'm like, "Wow, that's really cool, Albert." And he looked at me, and it was this like 13-year-old kid. And he says to me, "When I grow up, I want to be an evangelist." Okay, so I took a step back and looked at this kid and I said, "But Albert, you know, you already are one." And he like looked at me and he sort of nodded. I don't think he really realised, but he was. And so anyway, so that's the sort of relationship we have. And we'd talk about soccer or football, or whatever you want to call it here in Canada, you know, and we'd talk about Jesus, talk about God, talk about everything. Such an inquiring mind this kid had. But after a while, I realised that Albert started to miss school. And I realised that Albert was quite sick. And it transpired that Albert had the HIV virus, which was quite sad. And he developed full-blown AIDS. And if I was to stop the story there and just tell you a little bit about the issues of HIV/AIDS, was on our hospice programme at the moment in the region we work, probably 30% of our patients or members of their family have HIV. Now, this is a legacy, really, of what happened in Romania under Ceausescu when it was communist. He banned contraception. He made, if possible, every family to have a minimum of 5 children. So what he did was, when these families used to sometimes abandon the kids at state-run hospitals because they couldn't afford to have them, he said, "Well, that's okay. We can produce these orphanages and stick these kids into orphanages and we'll bring them up as good communist Romanian citizens." Well, the truth was that by the end of the 80s, 1989, when the Iron Curtain fell, these orphanages were in a terrible state because the country was pretty bankrupt. And I don't know if people might remember the images which were beamed across the world of what they found. There were over 100,000 children living in orphanages right across Romania in the most appalling conditions then. And the other thing he did, and the reason, one of the reasons we have such a high rate of HIV/AIDS, is he said that he should buy blood from the West. Because he believed that he could build up a strong race of people, you know, to build an army, to build factories, similar to what he'd seen in Korea, what he'd seen in China. He wanted it for Romania. And he started this program where he would buy blood, or the state would buy blood, and then they would physically inject, this sounds like something out of science fiction, but it happened, inject the blood into the babies which were in the orphanages because they thought they could build up a strong race of people. Well, we all know what happens if blood isn't screened properly, if it's not the right type of blood. people die, or they become infected by whatever's in that blood. And so even now, 20 odd years later, we have a legacy really of what Ceausescu did. And it was not only that, that was coupled with, at the time, bad medical practice, where five children would be injected for vaccination with the same needle. And so that, coupled with this bad medical practice, mean you have this legacy now of these young people who are now becoming, you know, adults and having children of their own, who still have the HIV virus, and who we work with. So it's you know, you can't sweep it under the carpet. It is still there. Anyway, going back to the story of Albert, and so that's one of the reasons we don't know how Albert contracted HIV/AIDS. Right. It could have been bad medical practice, could have been anything like that. So anyway, Albert eventually, remember this is in 2003, 2004, so that's a while ago, and Romania has got its act together. It's a loads better than it was. Right, let me just state that, because it is. It's so much better than it was. Albert ended up in the hospital in Bacău, which is northeast Romania at the time. And he used to come back with stories about the conditions of the hospital and at that time how the staff treated the kids. And especially if you were an orphan kid, or you had HIV and you're an orphan kid, you were classed as the lowest of the low. And he came back with stories of kids being tied up to beds in the last stages of their life. Very often the staff were indifferent to the suffering of the kids. And it wasn't necessarily their fault. They probably, at that time, didn't have the training on how to deal with somebody who was dying, or who was dying in pain, or, you know. And there wasn't a lot of dignity there. And very often it was the kids who would be with the other kids when they died. And so, first of all, I started to visit the hospital, and I started to see some of this stuff myself. And so we just started to go into the hospital and visit the kids when we could. And I wasn't living in Romania too much at that time. So I could only go when we were there and take volunteers in, and we'd take food in, because the food was diabolical at the time. And we would do games, we would do paintings, we'd do songs, we'd sit and pray with the kids. We'd just befriended the kids, really, this community. But then we started to think about, well, this isn't really enough. This is very temporary. And we started to form the idea, the vision for building a hospice, which is something they didn't have in this region of Romania. There wasn't one. And we thought it would be a place where the kids could come for respite, or come to die, if possibly, with dignity, because many of these kids didn't die with dignity. And it's the right of really every human being, I think, to at least have some dignity when you die, or be surrounded by people who care about you and love you. And anyway, so Albert got sicker and sicker. And, you know, unless there was going to be some form of miracle, Albert wasn't going to make it. And in January 2004, we'd started to build this hospice we were building. I went into the hospital and Albert was there. And he was really excited to see me.
Yeah.
And he was quite happy. He looked very sick, but he was happy. And he said, "Steve, I've got to tell you something." And I said, "Yeah." I sat down on the bed and I said, "Oh, you know, what do you need to tell me, Albert?" He said, "Well, my dad's come to visit me. And he stayed here for a week or two." I said, "Oh, Albert, you know, I'm really pleased that your dad's come to see you. It's really important that your dad's come to see you." And Albert said to me, "Steve," he said, "will you do something for me?" And I was like, "You know what, Albert? I'll try and do anything for you. I can, if I can do it." And he simply said this to me, this little boy. He just said to me, "Steve, will you pray for me?" Well, you know, I've prayed for many people in my time. And I sat down on the bed with him and I started to pray. And I felt too upset. I couldn't complete the prayer. And I had to leave the room. And I was with a friend, so luckily he continued. But I was too upset because, you know, part of me could see that unless there was going to be this miracle, Albert wasn't going to make it, really. And I was quite upset by that. And so I left the room and I knew that I had to come back to England in about 2 days. But I knew that I really needed to speak to Albert before I left, because I needed to tell him a few things. you know, because, you know, I loved this little boy, really. He wasn't my son, but, you know,
yeah.
I have kids of my own, but he wasn't my son. But I loved him. And so I went back to the hospital the next day and I sat down on the bed. And I just said to him, you know what, Albert? I said, I need to tell you a couple of things before I leave because I'm going back to England. And I said, look, Albert, you know that I love you, don't you? And he looked at me and he just said, I know you love me, Steve. I know you love me. And the next thing I said to him was, I said, and also more importantly than that, I said, Jesus really loves you. And he looked at me and he just said, I know he does. And I looked at Albert and I said, you know what, Albert, it doesn't matter what happens now. Whatever happens, it's going to be okay. It'll be all right. Because I knew that whether Albert lived or died, something would be provided for him. I just knew that. And so I left for hospital and I came back to England and we were building this hospice, as I say.
Right.
And we didn't have a name for it. So I went to my board of trustees in England and I said to them, look, you know we're building this hospice and we don't have a name for it. I said, why don't we call it Albert's House? Why don't we call it Casa Albert? Because this little kid spoke up for his friends, spoke up against injustice. You know, 14, 15-year-old kid said, this isn't good enough. And he came to us. We were his friends, I suppose, and we were people who could help. And so my trustees agreed, and I made a phone call back to Romania. I had an English friend who lived there, Adrian Woodruff. And I told him, I said, look, can you find Albert wherever he is before it's too late and go around and tell him, you know, that we're going to call this place Casa Albert. And without me actually knowing, my friend Adrian went round and found him at the flat about 2 or 3 weeks before Albert died. And he told him. And Albert, we actually caught it on video, which we show occasionally to groups and people because it's such a powerful piece of video. And his reaction was just, wow, you're going to call it after me? Yeah, Albert, after you. Because you're such an inspiration to us. What else could we call it? And so Albert, who did eventually die, unfortunately, and I still sort of miss him, but his legacy lives on. And the most important thing from his story is, if anyone, you know, is listening, and if there's any kids listening or anyone, is don't let anybody tell you that you're not good enough to do something. Don't let anybody tell you that you're rubbish or that you don't count, because you do. And if you've got a dream that is good and it's going to do something good, you should try and run with that. And Albert, if he hadn't have spoken up for his friends about the injustice he saw, we wouldn't now be able to go and probably, we treat 120 patients every month now, kids and adults in that region, and bring palliative care into a home for these kids.
Right.
And we've built up a real community of young people as well, people with cerebral palsy, people with spina bifida, people with tumours, people with AIDS, have become a real community, and they realise that they're not on their own. And I feel that where there's community, there's strength. And these boys, some of the boys and the girls who come to our day centre twice a week, have made friends and friends that they never would have. And I just think, you know what, Albert, your legacy lives on, your story lives on. It's not just, you know, you've gone and you died, but you've left something behind. And just recently, our Romanian arm, which is called Asociația Lumina, which means Association of Life, as I said, we put a fundraiser in place. We've just won a huge grant.
From
I'm not really sure if I'm allowed to say who it is, but I'll say it and you can edit it out later. We won a huge grant from Velux Foundations, which are in Norway, I think. They make the windows, the roof windows.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they were looking for an innovative project in Eastern Europe. And we applied and we were interviewed, and eventually, after about a year it took, they approved our project. And we're hoping now to build another hospice in Romania, in the city of Bacău, because we're on the outskirts at the moment. And it will be a 14-bedded unit for kids actually to come to for either respite care and families, or to come when they're terminally sick, if they can't die at home. And so it will provide these 14 beds. And we hope that we're able to reach now another three counties. So we'll be even, you know, the picture has got slightly bigger than it was before.
Right.
And it's been brilliant as well, because it's been driven, this project in some ways has been driven by our Romanians. And it's really great that they're now starting to grasp the concept of what we're doing and run with it. And two of our members of staff were actually asked to go to, I think it was Kazakhstan or somewhere like that, and speak at a conference about,
oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's sort of having this ripple effect.
Yeah.
You know, we're not the only people in Romania doing palliative care, but we're the only people doing it in this region. And so, yeah, that's our story, really. And I spend probably 5 months of a year in Romania now.
Wow.
Working with the Romanians and taking groups of volunteers out in the summer, and they come and work at the project, and they meet the kids. And we do things where, and we get them to meet the kids, which is a great way of, we run a sponsorship program to help sponsor the care. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it has to be paid for somewhere.
Right.
And we now have, on our association, we have around about 42, nearly 50 staff, which we employ. And we started with nothing, you know, in 98 when we went to Romania, we absolutely had nothing. And I'm not an electrician anymore. I'm a CEO stroke founder of Cry in the Dark and the president of the association in Romania. And I have a board of trustees I'm accountable in the UK. They're like my employers now. And there's only three of us who work in the UK.
Wow.
Two of us full-time and one part-time. And that's it, really. And the rest of all of our staff are in Romania where, you know, where it should be, where it should be happening. So, yeah, that's our story. I'm sort of here in Canada because I've got friends here who used to live in the UK, Robin Ann Mansell-Ward, who live around in Canmore.
Yeah.
And I met Karen Barker as well, who's become a good friend of mine. And I've come really to sort of relax before the summer comes and train for a massive bike ride, which we're doing in June to raise funds for our work. And we're cycling from San Francisco to San Diego in 7 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is about, I'll do it in miles. It's about 620 miles. I don't know what that is in kilometres. So we're doing, I've come to do some training, and it's a great place to train because we're at altitude and there's some good rides here. It's a beautiful country you got.
Yeah, oh, we're really lucky here in the Bow Valley, for sure.
Yeah, it's a lovely place to come.
Yeah.
So, that's one of the reasons I came here, yeah.
Awesome. What's one way that our listeners here in the Bow Valley and Canmore and Banff and everywhere really in Alberta can help out with the foundation?
That's a key question really for us. It's obviously financially is what's really important to us because to run the projects we obviously, and it's always a hard one, we always need money.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways it's easier for us to buy in-country food and clothes, and it helps the economy in Romania as well as, you know, because sometimes people send you things and you think, well, actually, we could get that in Romania and it helps the local economy that way.
Right.
So finance is always a great thing for us to receive from people. If people wanted to sponsor my bike ride over the next month or so when I do it in June, I'm actually doing two. I'm doing one in Romania of 240 miles, and then a week later I'm doing a 620.
A warm-up.
Yeah. But you can go online to sponsor me. There's a site which is run by Virgin, which is the same people who do the airline. And they run a site called virginmoneygiving.com. And if you put into the internet uk.virginmoneygiving.com, then a / steve.cooper, C-O-O-P-E-R, and then the figure 5, that will take you to my fundraising page. And it is easy to do. I don't think you have to sign up for anything. You can make a donation by credit card or debit card. And every penny of your donation, which comes for that sponsored ride, will go to the project. And I'll tell you why. It's because all the funding for the actual event is paid for by ourselves. It's paid for by, I pay something like £1,500 to do the event. And anyone else who's coming on, we've got 22 cyclists cycling now. They all pay to do the event. So that covers the airfares, the food and the hotels. So every penny of your sponsorship will go to the projects, wow, not to running the event.
Awesome.
And that's you know, so give us transparency. And I think in this day and age, that's really important for people. Mm-hmm. And people can sign up on that Virgin site. If they even just go to www.virginmoneygiving.com and put in Cry in the Dark, you can set up, if you wanted to, a monthly, you know, $10 a month if you wanted to help support, right, our work. And again, that will go to our work in Romania. On the website, there's a thing called, it's a child sponsorship page. We call it Prieten, which means friend in Romanian. And nice. You can become a friend of one of the kids at the hospice. And it's quite a personal thing. You'll get two sort of letters or updates, sometimes from a child or from a social worker who works with the child. And so we keep you informed. And also what we do, because of the very nature of the business we're in, sometimes the child will die. Sometimes a child has life-limiting illness and will live quite a long time. But we make it very personal. And when the child dies, we don't just send you an email. We actually call you and explain to you what's happened. Wow. It's a very personal thing. It's quite connected, very connected. So, yeah, so there are ways. And, you know, if there are any Christian guys listening, pray for us. You know, if you believe, then pray for us. Because for us, you know, that is the engine room of what we've done, and for me, really, although it's my story, I feel I can't compromise what I believe. I suppose I believe it was, you know, God who sent me there, and it's grown so much. I can't, you know, believe that's just me.
Right. Yeah, it's incredible. Awesome. So cryinthedark.org is the website that people can go to. They can donate there?
There is a donate button there, and I think that will take you to the Virgin page anyway.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then, what else can you do on that site? Just kind of like check out your story?
Yeah, there's a blog, and I think you can leave comments and stuff like that. Good comments, I hope.
Yeah, positive only, please.
Positive ones. I think there's other ways on how you can support on the website. And we work a lot, you know, in the UK, we work a lot with young people, getting them out to our projects and giving them the experience of working with people who are sick, people who are poor, and giving them a world vision instead of, you know, for instance, I live in Canmore and Canmore's might be all I know, or Calgary. It's just giving them that, well, actually, I've been to this country and I've seen how some of these people live. And it just opens up our minds. It opens up our hearts.
The broader scope.
Yeah. You know, because the world is a big place. But I was talking to Karen about this morning. But it's also a small place because you can jump on an aeroplane.
Yeah.
And you can be in. Yeah, you're there. Yeah. So there's, you know, we've taken school kids out, 15-year-old school kids with the teachers. Mm-hmm. And they get stuck in. And we've seen some great things with the kids. And we, you know, we're not about taking kids out there to indoctrinate them or anything like that. We're about getting them hands-on experience of working and doing something good. And it looks good on personal references. You know, you go and volunteer somewhere.
Right, yeah.
It looks great. And universities CV, and stuff like that. Love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. I know we're doing the UK now. We're starting to really look for that personal involvement.
Yeah, I think so. In Canada as well.
Yeah,
it's always really helps to have in your resume and your CV and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to highlight or push or promote?
No, Marcus. I think, you know, you've allowed me to come in, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, no problem.
And I'll thank Karen for allowing me to, you know, for organising. That's really lovely. And, I just love coming to Canmore. This is probably my fifth visit, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nice. So, you know, I keep coming back.
Yeah.
But no, you know, if anyone wants to check us out, check out the website, and I'm sure they'll find stuff in there they might need. Thanks, Marcus.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Marcus.
No problem.